in our cognitive abilities.
All right. In any event, Roy, unless somebody has something else, I'm done. WB2EAB.
KD2PHD.
PHD, was it?
Yes, Jim.
Thank you, Roy. Good evening, Roy and the group. I was wondering, Ed, you mentioned some instances where the details of some of those tragic situations were inaccurately reported on various versions of the news media. Have you come across that in other situations where you had better technical knowledge than most?
I do have a story. This may not be what you're looking for, but it's definitely what you're asking for. When I was in high school, college, I was living in Coney Island in a high-rise building and commuting by subway to school. And one day, there was a water main break where I lived, and I was involved in the middle of it. And then, lo and behold, in a day or two later, the New York Daily News had sent somebody and had an article on it. And reading the article, I realized how many of the facts in the article were actually incorrect based on my, you know, in-my-face observations. So the answer is, it's probably far more common than we ever realized.
Well, that's actually the answer I was looking for, because having spent a number of decades in the city in the emergency service work, I've found that me and everybody I've ever asked is unable to report one instance ever in decades of service times hundreds of people where the news has ever got any of the stories remotely right. Indeed, they don't even try. And that's a big observation, and most people will probably blow it off as craziness, but that's the actual fact of the matter. And you just brought up a number of examples of it that it's unfortunately the truth.
Well, yeah. Wow, I really nailed it. That was exactly what you were looking for. Wow, that was blind luck, huh? But meanwhile, yeah, the one I saw in the Times, not only did they say that radar altimeters date back to the 1920s, when they mean any kind of altimeter, but they had another one. They said that World War II fighters had radar altimeters. Why would a World War II fighter need a radar altimeter? But I know World War II fighters, the P-61 Black Widow was what was known as a night fighter, which we recognize today as radar targeting. And it was a big thing then. They were able to fit X-band radar using a magnetron noise developed by Taffy Bowen and his crew, including Randall and Boot. But they put it on a fairly large fighter. I mean, you need a fairly large fighter to hold up the radar, and it could target enemy bombers at night. And also, another little fun fact is they did use radar on bombers for targeting towards the end of the war. What finally solved the U-boat menace was the B-24 could cross the Atlantic. And what they would do is they'd have B-24s flying across the Atlantic basically at night with a radar. And they would pick up U-boats, because remember, World War II submarines could only submerge for 6 hours. They had to go on the surface part of the day, of course, at night. And the idea was to catch them on the surface at night and bomb them, and that was very successful. And also, they started using radar bomb sights at the end of the war, but definitely no altimeter.
AC2GS, I just want to put in my two cents worth to Chris, to John, rather. I tend to have a more forgiving nature, maybe. So I tend to think most of this is not due to maliciousness on these people's minds, but sheer incompetence. I have met many incompetent people in my life. And so I think, again, most of this nonsense is just due to sheer incompetence of a lot of different people.
Or being on a very short time schedule in Russia.
Well, I guess so. But again, you kind of, if you're a professional, theoretically, the idea is to give the right story. So if you don't have time to give the right story, I guess you make time. But okay, I guess so. But that's a really awful excuse for giving poor information that you didn't have time to get the correct information.
VDH for the comment.
Yes, John.
Now, when it comes to things, especially things that are RF related or radio related, there is a you'd be surprised how much ignorance there is out there. This is the things that that Dick used to talk about when they was talking about radiation, radio frequency radiation versus ionizing radiation. People would confuse the two, and it's just that people are just not knowledgeable about these things, especially things related to radio and electromagnetics in general.
KD2VHD, comment.
Yes, Jim.
I want to clarify what I was talking about were about the errors from the media were not like that at all. A broken clock is right twice a day. If you're incompetent, once in a while you're going to get it right. But, you know, the fire was yellow. No, it was orange. The electricity was AC. No, it was DC. You know, you can chalk them all up to small little technical errors. But the fact is, when you go through decades and they are never right, ever, not once, at times your friend and your friend's friend, and then 10 people working with you, and they're never, ever right, ever on anything. It can't be by accident. It's impossible. The odds are just astronomically doesn't happen. They're never right. So I know that sounds crazy and conspiratorial, but ask people that have been involved that know something about any news story themselves, and it's always the same answer across the board. So, sorry for the uncomfortable news, but that's the gig. KD2VHD.
Okay, Jim, you're free to have that that opinion. Unfortunately, I've known people who have less chance of being right than a broken clock. I've known more than a few people who pretty much I could rely that everything they said was wrong. And I don't think there was any nefarious reason, because they were deeply impressed with themselves at the time. It's just an abject lack of the faintest clue of what's going on in the real world. And whereas a broken clock is real twice a day, human beings who are really foggy can be foggy 24/7.
Roy, to get back on subject, I just thought of a real fun fact.
Okay.
About 10 years ago, the XYL and I went on a little vacation out to the southwest in New Mexico. And I made a point of dragging the XYL, who surprisingly had a pretty good time. We went to Los Alamos, you know, where the atomic bombs were developed in World War II. And she didn't give me a tenth of the hard time I was expecting, so I'm eternally grateful for that. But they have a very nice museum there. An interesting fun fact, number one, is it's known as the Bradbury Museum. after one of the guys who ran the lab for a while, no relation to Ray Bradbury of Fahrenheit 451 fame, but anyway, very, very nice museum. And no surprise, they had mock-ups of the two atomic bombs that were dropped at the end of World War II. Now, I have seen the same World War II vintage photos that were released many, many years later, you know, of the bombs. But I was absolutely shocked. The mock-ups of the bombs each had a Yagi antenna on each side facing forward. Two antennas, 180 degrees apart around the body, facing forward. And I said, what the hell is this? Nobody had a clue, and I figured it out. It was possibly the world's first radar altimeter. That the idea being, I realized, they probably wanted to set the bombs off at a specific altitude, and these Yagis were part of a radar altimeter for that purpose, and very possibly, like I said, the world's first radar altimeter.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that once before. I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of kind of hidden technology that unfortunately people forget, and it fades away, and you have to kind of reestablish it. But, you know, Bradbury's not an unusual name. There's a very famous building in Los Angeles called the Bradbury Building. That they did Twilight Zones there, they did Blade Runner in that building, and that too had nothing to do with Ray Bradbury or this gentleman at Los Alamos. We used to have a person who came on from IRLP through IRLP from Los Alamos. Unfortunately, other things apparently have gotten his time, so we haven't heard from John.
That's interesting. One last thing. Yeah. And I realized, I think what it was, the reason they weren't in the original pictures, it probably was so top secret that they did not want to even risk that getting out too early.
That makes sense, but, you know, it's a shame, that little added thing. I wonder if it's actually documented anyplace. You know, I mean, I've read, you know, encyclopedia entries and Wikipedia entries and other things, but I wonder if squirreled away in some strange book is any comment about those Yagis themselves.
I haven't made an exhaustive search, but on the other hand, I sure haven't found it.
Yeah, some research is easier than others. I doubt a simple Google would find it for you.
Should I tell you how I found the RTCA report?
Sure, I'm always interested in digging up stuff. I tend to have a decent ability. You know, I joke that I might have been a librarian in a previous life, but yeah, I'd love to know.
Wesley would love this one. From a YouTube video. Shall I elaborate?
Sure.
I have this thing. There are a couple of regular posters on YouTube. There's a fair cottage industry of people putting up stuff about analyses of airplane accidents. Now, most of them are like very experienced airline pilots or retired airline pilots who also fly for hobbies and this and that. Very experienced pilots are just giving their opinion. In other words, they just find out what they can after an accident and they say, boy, this sounds like such and such to me. And one of these guys who I kind of follow had one on the 5G and the airplanes from a pilot's perspective, and he was showing a chart showing the frequency bands and the spacings like you would imagine as I was describing with the different frequencies, coming right out of the report. At one point, he actually showed a cover of the report he had obtained. So I hit pause, was able to expand it, I was able to read it, look it up, and then Google it. That's how I found it.
Ah, very good, very good. Yeah, I waste too much of my time with guys trying to deal with flat Earth deniers.
You mean the Earth isn't flat? It's flat when I look out the window.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much for that. As a matter of fact, when we were talking about the flying, I sent you, Roy, a few days ago, a video with the guy. I hope. No, I didn't. Yes, I didn't. Okay. Anyhow, there is a video about the guy who made the wreckage from his airplane having 5 or 6 cameras on it. And now the FAA is investigating the story. It was in nearby Salt Lake City in the mountains.
You're not talking about Trevor Jacob, or are you talking about D.B. Cooper?
Travis.
Trevor Jacob bailing out of his plane with 7 go-to cameras?
You know it better. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know all about that one. Roy, shall you have a one-minute dissertation?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, I heard about that idiot.
Well, at first hand, it sounds reasonable until you look into it. First of all, this guy's flying along. Now, for some reason, A, the plane is instrumented with cameras with some kind of a link all over the place. For some reason, he is wearing a parachute. Let me tell you a rule of life. The only time you wear a parachute is when you expect you might get shot down, or you're in a, you know, like a rocket research plane that may blow up under you. You never wear a parachute under any other reason. He's wearing a parachute. The engine dies on him, and he bails out, and the plane crashes. Thank God the plane didn't hit anything. But then the pushback began.
Well, there is...
People were saying, what the hell is this nonsense? And another one, when the engine died, one guy pointed out he's pulling the yoke, which is, you know, the steering wheel, back and forth rapidly. He says, I have no idea what the purpose of that is. And then it goes on. And then another guy actually repeated it. He went to the exact same place in a different but similar plane. And he says, you know, you look at the air navigation map. I'm up at 9,000 feet. I can glide, you know, so many miles, you know, like 20, 25 miles from 9,000 feet. I mean, these small planes glide fairly well. And he did it. He cut the engine. He didn't turn it off completely. You know, just cut it back to zero power, but it was running in case he needed it. And he glided to the airport and landed. Another guy, now, several people have said, if you look down, you can see there's a river running through a valley in the mountains he's flying over. And the river has these wide beaches that would make a good emergency landing strip. And another guy actually landed there. And I assume he took off from there again, or I would have heard about it. So, like, everybody's saying this is absolute insanity, right?
One more thing. The guy had this sport parachute. truth, that a device to save them from high altitude and not exactly at the point of choice. So there was, he was maneuvering to be not away. And another thing is the door on the left-hand side was slightly open, as if he was expecting, unlatched from inside, as if he was expecting that he has to leave the airplane. There are plenty of things the FAA may pay attention to. And the people were speculating what was the reason. Did he do it for views on YouTube? But actually, the comments on the video of that guy are blocked, so he cannot leave the comment. But I was thinking about, wasn't that for insurance? And to Exxon.
Because census is, he did it for his YouTube reputation and police and all that sort of stuff. By the way, Buzzy, that was very noisy. You were popping in and out. But yeah, the consensus was he did it entirely for that, because the whole thing makes no sense except for that. And yes, they are expecting he's going to get into a lot of trouble. You do not send an unpiloted plane alone without a really, really good reason, especially when somebody else shows. He could have very easily glided to a number of places. Oh, one more fact. Let me let it drop. What am I doing, okay?
Yeah, you're doing fine. There's some interference going on around you, but I can hear you.
One thing people don't know is every pilot of a small plane is always, always, always looking for, where do I put this thing down if the engine dies? That is why pilots of these small planes very rarely want to fly at night, because you can't do that. And also, it is not quite illegal, but it's highly frowned on to fly over water further from land than you can glide back. Right?
Yeah, I think it's self-evident when you put all the pieces together that this is just another guy who's looking for a lot of YouTube fame. There's a ridiculous amount of money in that business. I'm confused why, but there are millionaires who the basis of it is some kind of viral YouTube that started them. So I believe an idiot would very likely take this approach to fame and fortune.
Yeah, that's the consensus of opinion, but, I mean, the way he did it was very, very, you know, rookie, amateurish, whatever you want to say.
What do you think? Because I'm not trying to go to the legal discussion, but if the guy had a choice but didn't use the choice, but he did all of the steps, the question is, if it was for the insurance money, everybody knows that that might be just something that was planned. But to prove that it wasn't or that it was is impossible. So my question is, the FAA can or cannot revoke his pilot license based on assumption? And the second thing is insurance able to revoke his rights to the insurance money based on assumption? And to a shield.
Easy answer. The videos that he put on YouTube are incriminating evidence. Here's the way it works. You're flying along, minding your own business, the engine dies. Step one, retrim the ailerons, you know, the rudder, the elevators for gliding mode. You put the plane in the mode where it's now a glider, so you get the maximum time and distance. Rule number two, check your maps. Is there an airport within the radius that you can make as a glider? Step three, if not, look for a soft spot. And in this case, there were plenty of soft spots and an airport. And there's filmed evidence of him not doing any of that. That is a violation by itself. So it makes the whole thing look so terrible. I mean, the video he wanted to get was the incriminating evidence of his illegality.
Thank you for that. Videos, Travis as the younger, because he's a young guy, jumping in Canada over the train with his snowboard, and it was made on the camera. I was taken on the camera. He was a few days in jail for some kind of minor, another trick. So his channel was, and the comments also that I saw were that his channel was made based on incredible adventure. Did I use the right words? Stupidity. Anyhow, back to you.
Roy, I think Paul is probably chafing up a bit.
I would agree with you. I want to thank you, Ed. It was a fascinating discussion. I want to thank the people who participated, Wes and Jim and the others. And I think it's more than enough time for Paul, WS2N, to drop upon us and give us the SpaceNet report. So take it away, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. And Ed, I would rather listen to these great stories, to tell you the truth. That's just terrific. Oh my goodness! Very well done. Very interesting night. And Wesley, I'm going to guess Wesley's got a mic problem. I don't know if it's in the push to talk button or maybe the mic cord. You know, I mean, he's got a solid signal. It's just that. That he's popping in and out one too many times. You might check that, Wesley. This is WS2N.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. How is it now?
No, that's good. But, you know, you were going on and on before. You know, you were on probably, you know, 20, 30 seconds, and you would, you know, pop in and out. Other times you would be good, and other times you would pop in and out.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for letting me know about it.
AC2GS, I think the problem is there's a listener who's somewhat unhappy, and that's probably why.
Okay, really? It didn't sound like that to me. Okay. Very good. Well, anyway, those last two transmissions were excellent, Wesley. Anyway, this is Paul for the... based that report, and we'll cover a few topics here. The Strato Launch. I've talked about the Strato Launch before. It's an airplane that was built by Paul Allen. Allen was partners with Gates, Bill Gates, back in the day with the computers, and when they split up, eventually he took his money and he did different things with it, and Allen built this. He wanted to build this airplane that was had two fuselage, and then had six Rolls-Royce. I think they're engines that came off the 747. So I don't know. Each engine is like 50,000 pounds of thrust. He's got six of them attached to this plane. It's a carrier airplane. The idea was, when he built it, he was going to drop rockets from it and the rockets would ignite, and then it would go into space. He would be able to carry a couple of them at a time if he wanted. It was so such a big airplane, including eventually man flight. He would, you know, he had plans on putting maybe a Dream Chaser type of craft attached to it with a crew of maybe two in there, and they would be able to fly to space. That was the ultimate goal. But, you know, he died like 3 years ago, and right at that time, it did fly once anyway. But since then, it's been taken over by another company. And since then, it's flown two more times. So it's three times since 2018. And its wingspan is huge. It's longer than a football field, the length of a football field, like 385 feet long. And the other day, it flew for 4.5 hours. They just taking it through its paces, making sure everything works, landing gears, and doing whatever they do when they test fly these planes. And their goal is to probably do a drop with a hypersonic vehicle probably by the end of the year. They call the vehicle that Talon is going to be Talon 0, Talon 1. They'll eventually have Talon 2. And the Talon will drop from the plane, and the goal is to eventually get up to about Mach 8 times the speed of sound. So that would definitely be a hypersonic vehicle. So it's all under development. We'll see what happens. You know, they talk about the Russians and the Chinese, and you know, even North Korea, they're developing these hypersonic vehicles. And they say, well, they got us beat, you know, right now. I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere out in the desert somewhere, you know, we have some development going on with these hypersonic vehicles. This is a private deal that they're going to have this ready by the end of the year. So, you know, talk about misinformation. I can't believe that we don't have something like that. But maybe we don't. Anyway, let me drop it. Hopefully this thing works. They thought at one time after Paul Allen died, well, maybe they're going to just retire this thing, you know, one flight and that was it. But it has been taken over. I mean, the article says that you could actually carry three of these Talon vehicles up at one time if you wanted to. And the Talon that they're developing is going to be used for research, for not only commercial use, but to help out the military as well. So they're going to make a series of flights. The Talon is designed to not crash, not burn up, or go into the ocean. It's designed to fly back and land on a runway and be reused. So I thought that was pretty cool. Any comments before I move on? WS2M. Okay, another topic here is the Russians did another EVA last Wednesday morning from the space station. Recently they brought up, last year they brought up two new modules to the International Space Station, the Nyoka and the Prinkle. Nyoka was attached to the Nadir port, you know, bottom-looking port facing Earth, large module, as big as the original service module that the Russians call home when they use that for sleeping quarters, for eating, for meetings. That's their big module. Well, Nyoka is just as big, and that was the one that was attached to the space station successfully, and then a couple hours later, the thrusters started going off unexpectedly, actually flipping the whole space station over. 1.5 flips by the time they got it under control, using other rockets to reverse the thrust of these other thrusters that went off accidentally on Nyoka. Eventually, they ran out of fuel, and they were able to get it under control. But, you know, since then, they've now attached the Pringle module, another module. They call it a node. It's got 6 ports on it. So one of them was attached to Nyoka, and they're going to use that for docking purposes for future spacecraft and also for future EVAs. They have another module that they did the EVA from, called the Poisk module. That was located on the Nadir port, one of the top ports of the Russian side of the space station. Anyway, the two Russians went out, and they needed to hook up data lines. They needed to hook up new antennas for the front end of the Pringle module for future docking, or these antennas communicate with whatever spacecraft is coming up. So they need power, cables had to be run, different cameras had to be relocated from one module to another, because now, you know, they have to hook it up to the most forward module. So different antennas, a couple of big antennas that needed to be disconnected, so big that they can't bring it through the 1 meter hole that they climbed through, the port that they climbed through. So rather than they can't take it apart, so they just toss it off into space, and eventually those two antennas will eventually burn up as they re-enter the atmosphere. But anyway, it was successful. They set up this, they have this crane up there, a small crane when they're looking at it, and then when they open it up, it's like 50 feet long. Not that quite long, about 40, I think they said 48 feet long. And they're able to stretch that out, and they use that as a guide to get from one module to another. Eventually they telescope that back in, put that away. And they'll be doing another EVA shortly, actually activating another larger crane that's been attached to one of the Russian modules for a couple of years. It just hasn't been used. They plan on activating that, and that's about 40 feet long, but it has the capability of inchworming across the Russian part of the space station. The American side, European space station, we have our 57-foot Canadian arm, number 2, that does that as well. They don't have anything for the Russian side, so this will be able to do any work or anything that they need to do in the future with their own robotic arm. So that's it. Both Russians are hams. They've made contacts with schools down in Russia, and so it's good to see some kind of good cooperation up in space. Anyway, we don't have it here on Earth. Not too good, but up there they're doing pretty good. Ever since 1974, when they did the Soyuz Apollo mission, when they joined up in space, we've been getting along with them in space for all these decades. That the Mir, remember we used to even have dockings. There were 5 dockings of the space shuttle to the Mir space station when the Russians had that. The space station was good for 15 years. They eventually burnt that up in the atmosphere on purpose when they decided to pour all their money and resources into the Russian side of the International Space Station. Let me drop it for any comments. Okay, I keep talking about these different companies that are going into business launching rockets. You have Firefly now. I expect them to make it to orbit this year, definitely. They almost did it late last year. they got close. I mean, first of all, they, Firefly launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They went west instead of east on purpose. They didn't want to go over land on a maiden flight. But it took off on time. Usually there's delays. Something's wrong on the launch pad. Let's abort for another time. Weeks and months pass by. But no, I mean, this thing went all the way down to zero. No weather issues. No constraints. Thing took off. First stage, beautiful separation to the second stage, and then things started to go a little haywire with the second stage. But they almost made it to orbit. I suspect they're going to be able to do that on the next flight. That's, you know, one company, and then these other companies. Rocket Lab has been flying many flights in the last 4 years with the Electron rocket, successful. They had their problems at the beginning, but, you know, I think they're up to, like, 20 flights now or more that have been successful. They plan on reusing their first stage this year. They plan on catching it with a helicopter, bringing it back to a ship. The ship will eventually bring it back to land and eventually reuse those first stages, similar to what SpaceX has been doing all these years. Now, there's other companies that are being developed. Relativity is being developed. Everything, the engines, the rocket itself, is going to be 3D developed, manufactured. But here's this other company, ABL. ABL is developing a two-stage rocket, relatively small, about 50 feet long. But very powerful. They're claiming it's going to be able to put the equivalent of 3,000 pounds into low Earth orbit, where Rocket Lab has been doing this now for quite a few years now. You know, their payload is like 600 pounds. So we'll see how ABL does. Right now, it's not too good. Last week, they were testing the second stage out in Mojave, California, and next thing you know, the thing blew up on a test pad. So here's this company that just started in 2017. You know, it's like four years old, a little over 4 years old. They haven't gotten anything off the, never mind to orbit, but off the ground at all. And yet there are companies and investment firms pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into this company. This contract signed up. He's got a manifest. This ABL company has a manifest for, I don't know, the next couple of years. Private companies, the U.S. government, military, they're investing with them. Even Amazon wants to, you know, they plan on putting up their own broadband systems into space. They're signed up with this company. And frankly, I really don't get it. I mean, you know, how could you, these people are just investing. It's like money doesn't mean anything. Do they really believe all these people are going to get off the ground? I mean, there's been a couple of failures. Lynx was one company. They failed. They went under. Vector went under. It's going to make it. I thought they were going to do good, and they went under. It's unbelievable. It's like, you know, you tell somebody, you know, that you know something about the space program, and you know a couple of people. Next thing you know, they're going to give you hundreds of millions of dollars to start developing these things, whether you succeed or not. So I hope they make it. They have this weird name, ABL, Alpha Bravo Lima. As far as I'm concerned, it stands for nothing. I searched the internet. I know Roy always says Google is your friend. If anybody finds out what ABL stands for, let me know. So, I don't know. I'm going to use the word. I'm going to take the word L or the letter L and make a launch out of that. Well, AB is because they couldn't think of anything else, but it's really strange. So, you know, you take a company, never put a rocket into space. Never got one off the launch pad yet. Blowing one up on a test out in the middle of the desert somewhere by accident. With a name like ABL, and yeah, sure. Hundreds of millions of dollars, no problem. So, the space business looks like it's really on fire. Any comments? WS2M. Okay. Anyway, let me go on to an SDS story here. SDS, Space Launch System, is going to be flying Artemis, eventually Artemis 1, probably this fall. They'll finally get off the ground after years and years of delays and over $10 billion of investment by NASA. They should be able to launch this thing, and they plan on sending the uncrewed vehicle, but, you know, it's an actual vehicle, the Orion spacecraft. I mean, if they have everything in there, they don't have an oxygen and nitrogen tanks attached. But, you know, I guess if you're in there, you probably won't be able to breathe. But, I mean, everything else is going to be set as if there was a crew. And they plan on going around the moon, coming back. It's roughly a 22 or 23-day mission. Orbit the moon, eventually deorbit the moon, and come back to Earth. And, of course, if that all works out and they land successfully in the Pacific Ocean with their thermal protection system and the parachutes and everything works fine, eventually the next flight will do the exact same thing, except with the crew. They won't land, but they'll duplicate this mission that's coming up, and eventually the flight after that, they're supposed to eventually land on the moon. But we'll have to wait and see. Anyway, they have to get this thing off the ground first. It should be quite impressive, 8.5 million pounds of thrust, which is, it's bigger than Elon Musk's Falcon 9 Heavy. And they get a little over 5 million pounds of thrust on that thing. But this is going to have 8.5 million pounds of thrust, actually with a lot more fuel. So they'll be able to push maybe 30 tons eventually to the moon with the rocket designs that they plan on. Eventually they're going to increase the size of the second stage, eventually increase the thrust of the boosters that they're using. Anyway, NASA is really going to make a comeback if this thing is successful. We'll see how it goes. The reason I brought it up is I wanted to talk about these satellites that are going to be going up with it. When Artemis launches, they're going to be bringing 10 satellites up with them. You know, at the very top of the rocket, you have this launch escape system that would pull the vehicle away. They're going to have all of that in place. Then you have the spacecraft itself. Behind that, you have the European Space Agency built service module. It's going to have all fuel, living things for the astronauts, the oxygen, nitrogen, and all. In the European service module, it's going to have many thrusters on board, I think 24 thrusters, fuel for the thrusters. And that European Space Agency service module was designed from the ATV, automated transfer vehicle that European Space Agency used to launch to the International Space Station. They launched 5 of these things over the years. Every year or so, they would launch another one. They don't do that anymore, but, I mean, that used to bring up a tremendous amount of cargo, around 13,000 pounds of stuff each time they went up, plus equipment. But they don't do that anymore. But it was such a reliable piece of equipment, the spacecraft, the European Space Agency, had developed using the ATV, that they took the same design and developed the service module for NASA. So it's got these big solar wings that come out in an X fashion to develop power. Below that, you would attach to an adapter, and that adapter would attach to the second stage. In that adapter, they're going to carry these 10 satellites. So this thing will be on the way to the moon, and eventually that will be exposed to space. They'll be able to discharge these 10 satellites one at a time for different purposes. So, maybe once in a while I'll go over what each one of these satellites they plan on doing, what colleges they're from, and what there's one from Japan. Anyway, there's one that's called the NEOSAT. NEOSCOUT is a CubeSat. CubeSats are usually 10 centimeters cubed, or roughly four inches square cube. And this is a 6U version. So, each unit, if you have two, it would be a 2U. This has got the equivalent of six of these CubeSats attached to one another. So after it's deployed, it'll open up. It'll have solar panels that will deploy. It's got little mini thrusters. The same thrusters that we used on the Marco mission. The Marco was the Marco A and Marco B were the ones that went to Mars with the InSight flight. When the InSight went to Mars, successfully landed on Mars. That's not a rover, that's the one that landed on Mars. It did all the surveying of the what would be Mars quakes. It had a seismometer that they put on Mars. Anyway, it had these two spacecraft that follow along with it that they use as repeater systems for when it landed on Mars. It would transmit information up to Marcos, and Marcos transmitted back on the X band to Earth. Those Marcos had little tiny thrusters with they use the same propellant, same thrusters that was on that. They're going to use on NEOSCOUT. And what's going to happen is eventually it's going to open up this Mylar, blanket or sail, really a sail. And the Mylar blanket will actually use the sun to propel it. It's going to be a solar propulsion type of satellite, which will start off as an extreme large orbit around the moon, but eventually, within a year or so, there's this asteroid that's going to be coming by, and the asteroid is as big as a school bus, and this NEOSCOUT will eventually find its way to there, and it's got cameras on it, and seismometer and everything. It will eventually send information back, but it's the idea of using solar propulsion to do this type of thing, which is, they've done it before, different experiments, but this one's actually going to be put to a practical use of investigating a smaller asteroid. Any comments or questions? WS2R. Okay, nothing heard. The first Atlas V of the year has took off. So that I watched that live on Friday afternoon from Cape Canaveral Launch Complex 41, and that successfully took off with one booster on it. Atlas V can carry up to five different boosters on it. This one, they just have one mounted off to the side. I know it doesn't seem very bisymmetric to do that, but they've done it before. In fact, they did it with Osiris Rex. That went out to, it's still out there. But that is, will eventually bring back material to Earth from an asteroid. But this one launched to two satellites to geosynchronous orbit. It's a government launch, but there are basically cameras, and they successful flight to geosynchronous orbit. They called the GSS-AP. It's for the Space Force, U.S. Space Force Geosynchronous Space Situational Awareness Program. There's a couple of satellites out there, and these two will be supplementing them and eventually replacing the ones that are there. It's the first time it flew with this large diameter fairing as well. This fairing that they use, usually they're 5 meters, around 16 feet in diameter. This one's larger. 17, a little over 17 and a half feet, which makes it actually a little bit larger than what SpaceX has, which I was surprised, but everybody's getting better at this stuff. But, the bigger they are, the more satellites that they can put in, or the larger satellites they can fit in the fairings. And of course, the Atlas V is designed to fly humans. Atlas V will eventually, hopefully this year, be able to launch the first unmanned crewed vehicle, the Starliner, up to the International Space Station, followed by a three-person launch start. Eventually, if all goes well, be launching four people on a regular basis up to the space station, similar to what SpaceX does with their crewed Dragon vehicle. Anyway, that's about all I had for that. Starlink, of course, they keep launching vehicles. The Starlink by SpaceX launched successfully another, I think it's 40, I don't know, 40 some odd satellites. They just launched 50. I think these are more involved. They now have laser communication systems on them. I think they got a little bit bigger or heavier or something. Each one is around 500 pounds. So they sent another group up there now. For the first time, they are now over 2,000 satellites that they have launched for their broadband system. About 400 or so are not operating. I mean, they either didn't work, they deorbited them, or, the whole first group is eventually going to be replaced by these new ones with the laser systems on it. They are up and running. They don't have complete coverage yet of the Earth. They need, I guess, a couple of thousand more. Like, I think they need roughly four thousand to have complete coverage.
That time complete.
They were going to use this. They thought maybe they could use it with that volcano that blew up, that island, Tonga Island, that's been decimated. But I don't think they have enough satellites, according to information that was released by SpaceX, to cover that area. But, eventually they would have been able to if they had a couple of thousand more up there. Anyway, they keep doing this, and eventually they plan on eventually doing it with their new Starship that they're developing, which, they've launched a couple of times suborbital flights. have gone up 6 or 8 miles high. I think one time they got up to 12 miles high. And anyway, they come back and land on Earth. Their first launch should be sometime this year. If the FAA gives them the okay, right now they have problems with the FAA. I mean, you talked about that earlier. This situation is no different.